Hello and welcome to another episode of The Cocktail Conceit. This is a podcast where two friends who are also bartenders talk about a piece of media. One of us brings a piece of media that they've enjoyed or had in their life and that the other one hasn't seen before, and then we talk about it, and then at the end of the episode, we have to make a cocktail based on that piece of media, because that's the conceit. Hey, my name is Adam Haskins. I'm a craft cocktail bartender who has been unemployed for a year because there's been a plague, and I've moved locations yet again. I'm in LA this time now.
You sure are. My name is Logan Redden, and I am also a craft cocktail bartender living in Evansville, Indiana. I also event coordinate, which has not really been a thing I've been doing lately, but, you know, it is what it is.
Not a lot of events to coordinate.
I'm getting a lot more calls now because Evansville is currently pretty low in infection rate. So, you know, not really a thing I think people should be doing, but... The state of Indiana says it's not that mad about it if you do. So, you know.
The state of Indiana and I guess like the U.S. in general is just like, fuck it. If you die, you die. Let's just muddle on with
this. I mean, we've kind of been at that level for a while, I think. Actually admitting it.
Yeah. Now they're just saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah. It's just slowly saying the quiet part out loud.
Well, other than that, how you doing, Logan?
Not too bad, actually. So I'm going to be moving into a new place on Friday, starting to move on Friday, probably be fully moved in by that Saturday or Sunday, this coming Saturday or Sunday. So that'll be a big change. But it does mean my cost of living is going to go down a bit, which is super cool because I'm going to get a roommate and I'll have like three times the space. So
I thought Toby was going to like that.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering how he's going to adjust to that because he has not really lived in a large place before. Cat proofing is going to be fun because he already gets into a bunch of shit in my tiny apartment, and it's gonna get worse.
So what are you drinking there?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Adam. This is a New York sour, but I gussied up a little bit more. Even it's rye whiskey. I did an absinthe wash. And I used the Christmas bitters that you gave me.
Nice.
That are actually really nice. Well, it's mostly because I ran out of Angostura bitters. And I haven't gone to pick up any more yet, is the real reason. But they actually work pretty well.
That Christmas bitters recipe that I have is actually pretty fucking good.
It's pretty good. You're going to have to send that to me, honestly.
Yeah, it's super easy to make. You just need like some good fresh ingredients. It's rosemary, star anise, and clove.
That makes sense. I was getting the anise for sure.
Yeah, but you gotta have like really fresh rosemary, and like it's hard getting that flavor out. And I believe that. Do you still get any rosemary on the nose and in the taste?
No, not really.
Okay, I think the rosemary kind of goes away after a while, but it's still like probably a nice like clove and anise bitter. And I think the rosemary plays some part in the background because if you just try and do clove and anise, it's like
yeah, I believe that. I mean, rosemary is a pretty subdued kind of flavor anyway.
Yeah, it definitely gives those bitters its color. Otherwise, it would just be brown.
We had some, over lockdown, our owner bought a big bag of rosemary fries. They were like tossed in like a rosemary like seasoning. They were really good. Like really, really good.
Rosemary fries. I love rosemary.
Yeah. Yeah, they were like, God damn it. Okay. I forgot a shot glass. Give me one second. Adam, you want to explain what's going on?
Okay, so after so many episodes, Logan and I have finally listened to enough of our podcasts that we've decided to be better at what we're doing. So we are going to stop saying the word like. And every time we say that word, we have to take a shot. Now, these aren't going to be like 2 ounces of full strength liquor. These are going to be like small shots of pre-batched cocktails that we've made ourselves.
Speaking of, the pre-batched cocktail that I made is a Manhattan. Also using said Christmas bitters and rye whiskey and Cokie Verino.
Cookie Tyranna is the best of Maria's. I think we've said that enough times, but yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. I try to like. Guess that's a double. I try to recommend that to everyone I can because it's very good, and it doesn't seem like a lot of people know about it. Not compared to like even among like bartenders
yeah,
who like cocktails.
I have no idea why. Like people like. People deeper into the States, the farther you are from the coast, the harder it is for you to like know about things such as
you said
Cookie Tyranna. Did I say it again?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. All right.
This is going to be a lot harder than we thought.
Oh, it's I know. Fine.
You know, but we did get through most of that intro without doing it, and this is a good introduction to it. So let's take these shots.
Hey, hey. Ho, ho. These shots have got to go. I'm doing shots of
delicious.
Sort of a modified Trinidad sour. It's Plantation 3 Star and Angostura de Amaro.
Ooh, I need to get a hold of some of that.
It's really good. It's about $30, and the only way I know how to get it in Indiana is to pay an additional $30 to have it shipped to you. So $60.
I mean, worth it? That sounds worth it.
I think it's worth it. I really like it. It's one of my favorite Amaros.
There's definitely some Amaro that you would spend that much just on a bottle, so.
Oh, yeah. And
doesn't seem that bad to me.
Oh, okay. So what I'm drinking normally, though, is just a bourbon old-fashioned.
Nice. I was actually, I bought a bottle of Old Forester bourbon. I think it was just a regular bourbon from Schnucks, and it had like a package deal that came with a little bottle of their old-fashioned syrup mix, which I don't really know what exactly it had in it, but I decided just to make some old-fashions while I had that since I got it for free, and it was pretty good, actually, not bad, and I just drank old-fashions for a little bit.
I've noticed this about myself. I get stuck on a cocktail for a while, for like a season or just an amount of time.
Yep.
And I'll just like, that'll be every other drink I have for a little while. Last summer it was Caipirinhas, and then it transitioned to Rob Roy's. And most recently I've been on a real like just simple daiquiri kick. Just like
daiquiris are just really good.
They really are.
They're really solid. And like,
but I think I am moving off of daiquiris right now, and I don't know if old fashions are going to be what I am all about for a while, but it could be. This is tasting pretty good.
Old fashions are really good. I definitely prefer Manhattans personally, and I probably always will, just because I think there's a lot more, you get a lot more complexity out of
your
vermouth choice, and I think that's a big deal, and I think it's not something that enough people pay attention to.
I like Manhattans.
Bartenders I know,
but I like Manhattans and Rob Roy's more than I do like old fashions. But I will say, when I make old fashions, I make old fashions with bourbon. I don't make old fashions with anything else. I don't make old fashions with scotch. I don't make old fashions with rye whiskey. Old fashions are for drinking bourbon.
You know, I think that's totally fair, because my thing with bourbon in most cocktails is that it tends to get really overshadowed by whatever other ingredients. Even like, even in a whiskey sour, bourbon is overpowered really easily by the sour and the simple.
And the egg and whatever you put on top of the egg to make it smell.
Yeah, all the other ingredients. It doesn't really stick out. So I would always prefer a rye whiskey sour. Like,
you're going to have to call me out.
I have right here.
Yeah, you're going to have to call me out, because I don't know if I will notice when I'm doing it.
I will 100% call you out, just because I don't want to be the only one taking shots.
Good. Yeah, you should. Oh, also, my partner Kat is in the other room, and she said she'll take shots with us when we have to.
That's fair. Well, she's two behind, I think, unless she already did them.
Well, she did a big shot just before we started recording.
Okay.
Just she's so she wouldn't have to catch up. Yeah.
That's fine. It's going to happen a lot. I'm very, very certain after recording that previous episode. After editing that previous
after,
episode.
Yeah, that's, we finally were like, no, we have to make a change. That's it. Fine, we're making a change.
And this is a distinct decision, and it's also a lot of fun. So, it works out. So anyway, you're drinking Old Fashioned. What bourbon did you use? Just, if you don't mind me asking.
Buffalo Trace.
Fair.
Buffalo Trace is so good. It's just solid.
Yeah.
Man, it is just a good whiskey, and good for the price, too.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Buffalo Trace, of all the big name bourbons that are out there that like everyone knows the name of, that's probably my favorite.
I think the reason why I like it so much is that it has a really high corn ratio in its mash bill. To be a bourbon, you have to be at least 51% corn, but almost no bourbon that you ever like have... but almost no bourbon that you have ever... heard of uses anywhere close to just 51% corn. They'll use a very, very standard mash bill that you'll find in like, all right, gonna make this a double. A very standard mash bill.
You should invest in a separate container to put your cocktail mix in.
Well, I have it in this shaker tin that I made it in, and I just have this shot glass that I'm gonna slowly meter it out in because I don't have anything else that pours really well.
That's
here
not
right
a shot
now.
Glass. That's a glass. That's just a glass.
I know it's just a glass, but it's what we have been using as shot glasses while we have stayed here in this Airbnb. All right. That's anyway, fine.
As long as you can measure properly, it's all that matters. There you go. That's it. There you go.
Okay. A very standard mash bill for bourbon that you'll find in most mainstream bourbons, like. Such as Jim Beam or things of that nature, is about 60 to 65% corn, and then 10% is going to be malt barley, and then the rest is going to be whatever your flavoring grain is. Usually rye, sometimes wheat if you're Maker's Mark or Pappy Van Winkle or Larceny. But
isn't Woodford also high wheat?
I'm
wrong about that.
I don't think Woodford is a wheated bourbon. No.
No, you're right, because they do make a wheated Woodford. They make a wheater,
standard
a wheated Woodford and a rye.
So. Yeah, standard Woodford is just pretty much like the standard mash bill, which is like 60-65% corn, rye, 10% malt barley. But Buffalo Trace, its corn in its mash bill is about like, all right, making this a double. The corn in its mash bill is about 80%. Okay. So it has...
Wow, that's pretty high, actually.
It's pretty high. I'm pretty sure it's 80%. We don't know for sure, but it is somewhere around 75 to 80%. It is higher than industry standard.
I will say that's one thing I don't really care for about Buffalo Trace. I know they do this with Blanton's. The Blanton's mash bill has never been released officially. There's good guesses. I was about to say it. Let's pour it.
Okay, pour a shot, but you don't have to take it yet. Okay, just take it.
It was a quarter. So anyway, there's very good guesses on what Blanton's mash bill is, but no one's really for sure because it hasn't been officially released, and that's true for several Buffalo Trace bourbons and whiskeys that they have released. And I don't really care for that. I actually really like any... That doesn't count. For the record. Syntax matters.
Syntax matters.
Syntax matters. Anyway. I really, really appreciate any distillery that just makes that information known, obviously on their bottle. Whether or not I actually enjoy said whiskey or bourbon, I do really appreciate that because it's just like putting it all out there. Like that one does count. I'll pour that one. I'll drink it next time.
I know what you mean though. I am really not a huge fan of hidden information.
Exactly.
Especially in the bartending world, because there's this really big, subcurrent in bartending culture that you want to hide your secrets and stuff, so you won't like
no I hate that.
So you won't, people won't tell you their cocktail like builds and stuff. And I
need it again.
Oh fuck. Alright. One.
Yes, no, exactly.
Two. Cheers.
But so yeah, no, I agree completely. It there is a secretive kind of nature to bartending and distilling in liquor creation
that I and don't blending.
Really, yeah, I don't really care for it because I get the idea of protecting your trademark or whatever the fuck, protecting your recipe because you don't want someone else to copy it. But I feel as if we live in a world currently that's not really a thing you need to be worried about.
You could say that we live in the information age.
We kind of do. We sure do. And the benefits of sharing all that information, I think, are much higher than keeping it secret.
I don't actually think that there is any benefit to not sharing information. If I make a cocktail and I have a build for it, I will share that. And I will share it and I'll have its name out there. Because if it's a good cocktail, people will want to make it.
Yeah.
And as that long doesn't as, mean well yeah, that doesn't mean that I'm gonna go out of business if I share how I make something.
Yeah.
Oh, case in point, the Carousel in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's the home of the Vucare. The Vucare was first made there. Mm-hmm. It's still in business. Tommy's in Miami, home of the Tommy's Margarita. Mm-hmm. Still in business. Well, I haven't checked in the last 6 months, but
that could we can
plague notwithstanding, a lot of those places are still going.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. That losing, even if other people start making a recipe, it won't really make a difference. I kind of get it from an old world perspective, in the time period when you couldn't just Google who is the first person who came up with said cocktail, because even now there are certain cocktails we have majority of cocktails we have no idea who came up with them at all. That's not really an issue cocktail. We have now any cocktail that was made past like 1950, we're pretty sure who came up with it. Like, god damn it, I have that shot.
Like the Naked and Famous. It was made at Death & Co. in New York City. We know the bartender who made it. We know the year that they made it and on what menu. And it's a great cocktail. I have made people a Naked and Famous at bars all around the world. In Australia, New Zealand, in the US.
I've never made that cocktail.
It's great. It's a good cocktail. It's a club cocktail. It's a riff on a last word. Okay, fuck, what's in it? It is yellow chartreuse. I want to say, what is the main spirit? Man, I'm going to get fucking rained for this. I don't know. But
I have no idea either.
It is a good cocktail. And yeah, share with the world. It always makes... Did I say it twice? Mm.
You said it once at the beginning and then just then.
Damn. Just
then. I'm just going to start.
Yeah, holding up fingers.
I'm just going to hold up fingers. That's a good way to do it. All right, interrupt.
Pour one.
You can finish your thought, but you got to take the shot.
Okay, that's a good way. Well, the other person will hold up fingers so you can finish your thought.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm already kind of fucking drunk. So,
I did not think it would go this fast. So
I didn't either. We should just start talking about the topic.
We should get to the topic because this
this is gonna devolve very quickly.
Okay, so our taking a shot, getting kind of drunk during this episode is very much on brand, because what we're talking about is a documentary called A Nation of Drunkards. This is the first in three documentaries about Prohibition that Ken Burns made in like 2011. That's one.
It sure is. I didn't even catch that one, I'm not going to lie.
No, I caught it. I caught it as it was coming out of my mouth, and I was like, fuck. I was like, also, it's going to get harder because we're going to get drunk. And so we're more likely to... Okay, that doesn't count. We're more likely to include fillers in our sentences.
I think if you say it, if you say it in a context that it that is
not a filler.
Yes, I agree. Only when used as filler. Only when used as filler. The phrase quotations as like don't count.
Yes, if we're using similes and yeah,
or okay. If you enjoy something.
Yes. Anyway, what we are talking about is the first episode of the three-part miniseries about Prohibition that Ken Burns made. This one is called A Nation of Drunkards. Mm-hmm. Which, I've watched... Oh, yeah, go on.
I was going to say which Adam picked. This was his
pick. Yes, I picked... I have seen this documentary series before. I liked it so much... That doesn't... I liked it so much that... I actually bought the book it was based on and read through that as well.
Wow. That's impressive, yeah, actually.
It is. I have always enjoyed the 1920s Prohibition era aesthetic. And so when Ken Burns made a documentary about Prohibition, I was like, oh, fuck yeah. I went from like 6 to midnight. And I'm like, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, you're rock hard for Ken Burns' documentary. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, he makes really good documentaries.
He does, that's a fact. I don't think I've seen any of his other documentaries.
Oh, fuck. I said it.
Oops.
Ken Burns
I'm actually very proud of myself because I haven't said it. Well, I said it a bunch at the beginning.
I didn't say it as much in the beginning, and now I've started saying it a large good. Amount.
Pretty good. Anyway. Yeah, no, Ken Burns... as I have heard, makes very good documentaries. I think this is the first one that I've actually watched.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, wow, okay.
There's not another one that I can specifically remember, so.
He has a bazillion-part series on baseball.
Gross.
It's literally about nine parts, and they're all feature length.
I'm sorry. He has a 9-part documentary on baseball, but a 3-part documentary on fucking Prohibition?
Well, okay. To be fair, baseball has gone on for...
much longer than Prohibition.
For about 150 years.
Yeah,
so.
But I feel as if Prohibition was maybe a more impactful societal event than baseball.
This is true, but again, it was impactful. Like, you can nail that. Prohibition, over it was this. Baseball has been going on for a long time, so it's had impacts on society for all those time periods.
You're not
it's
wrong.
Like, you're not fuck, wrong. I said it. Because you can talk about, there's a whole movie called A League of Their Own, which is about, hey, all the boys are off to war in World War II. What's going to happen? But for baseball...
girl sports, that's the answer.
You can... also have a documentary about, hey, the Spanish-American War is happening. All the boys have gone to Cuba. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, I guess that's true. If you're and going, yeah, if you're going from the beginning of the history of baseball to the end of the current history of baseball, then that is a lot.
Yeah, you have to cover all those parts, and it's supposed to be
there's
a
probably way too much filler though.
And once you get to more modern time and like, fuck, okay, I'm pouring two, my count's at two.
You're okay.
Once you get to more modern times, you have things such as the steroid scandal.
That's
and
true.
That could be a whole documentary.
That's, you know, that's a fair point, actually.
All right, cheers.
Cheers. I haven't said it again, so I'm going to take another shot because I need to pace myself. This is more of a game of me trying to pace myself than it is a game of me not trying to say a word. Anyway,
yes.
Here's what I'll... So I do definitely agree with your point about really enjoying the 1920s and that roaring 20s kind of atmosphere. Just to, like, bury the lead a little bit, I think the reason I didn't like this part, I enjoyed this part, I learned a lot, but yeah. I think the thing that makes this part probably the least interesting, I'm gonna guess, of the three, is that almost none of it takes place during the 1920s.
No,
none of the material it's covering covers that. It covers the lead up to the Prohibition, which is very important, But yeah. Most of it takes place during the 1800s, and for the most part, I find the 1800s to be some of the most boring parts of American history.
I absolutely agree. American history
outside of the Civil War. Outside of the Civil War. I just want to put that out there.
That's not necessarily even interesting.
It sucks.
It sucks. It's more of a bummer than interesting.
Well, no. That's okay. I want to explain that further, because me just saying it sucks could be very vague.
Interpreted in different ways.
The Civil War should have happened much sooner. It sucks because it ever had to happen, because the Revolutionary Fathers, the Founding Fathers, decided amongst themselves that it was better to be... better to agree with slavers and have them help them against the British than to work against them. And that's not really even fair, fighting amongst themselves.
So I...
thought the greater evil was being separate from the British, when the actual greater evil was slavery.
Slavery, yeah. So I've heard a fan theory, mm-hmm. That says the reason why the American Constitution is so much about freedom and has so many very specific call-outs to what it means to be free and mm-hmm. what you are not allowed to impose on other humans is because that the Constitution was drafted by Thomas Jefferson and a bunch of other Virginians who were heavily involved in the slave trade, so they knew exactly what freedom didn't look like. Mm-hmm. So they wrote in very specific terms how they did not want to be treated, because Yikes. They could Oof. See how slaves were treated, and they thought,
Oof.
we don't want to feel like that. And Man. That's why the Constitution, if you read it, all men are created equal. It very much looks as if they want to say slavery is terrible and nothing about slavery is good, because they were so intimately aware of slavery and the things that come along with it.
It's almost like all of those privileged white guys are being treated like second-class citizens by the British, and they really didn't like that because it made them... think that feel. They were closer to slaves than they were free people. And they didn't like that. That's really weird. It's almost like they should have gone further than that and thought, it really sucks that I feel kind of slighted by a higher class than me. Maybe I should carry that over to the people that I'm currently enslaving.
There's so many people who just never ask the second question.
Yeah, that happens a lot in history. Mm-hmm. Way, way too much. Way,
Spoiler,
way too much.
There, it happens a lot in modern times.
Yeah.
Where people are good, but you gotta ask the second question.
All like, the time. Maybe even a third question. Maybe even a third.
You know what? Turtles all the way down.
It is turtles all the way down.
But this...
Also, at some point, we need to talk about Terry Pratchett. That needs to be a thing. You've never read a Terry Pratchett book, right?
I have not.
Okay, that's going to be a thing. We're going to do that pretty soon.
Okay, we should. All right, well, let's get back on to...
Prohibition.
Prohibition, or...
Specifically, the first part of Prohibition.
Prohibition, the lead-up to Prohibition.
The lead-up.
I took a bunch of notes this time, which is off from normal, because usually you're the one who takes a lot of notes and...
Yeah, I do.
...watches the thing multiple times. I watched it multiple times and took notes.
I watched this one full time and then almost a full time because I didn't have quite enough time to finish before we started recording. And I probably could have taken notes, but for the most part, I didn't really care enough about all the... I'm gonna be completely honest. The fact that most of the reason Prohibition happened was because of the temperance movement really turns me off a lot. I will say this documentary gave me a good foundation on the other reasons besides religion for why this happened.
It was mostly religion, though.
I think that's not entirely fair, and I think that's not exactly what the documentary says. I think religion was definitely a big factor, for sure. Mm-hmm. And when I learned about prohibition in class, like through school, in the very limited sense that I did, that was always the main reason given. That it was always portrayed as this was a fully religious movement, that was the broad strokes of it. And for me as a person, and I grew up Catholic, was raised mostly Catholic, took confirmation, did all the things at a later age than most people do, but I think that also means that I was probably a bit more into it than some other people were.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually grew to really dislike religion, and I think that's mostly also because of my Catholic upbringing. That has always made me really not like anything that used religion as its main argument, especially when it comes to politics or like social change or whatever. If your main argument is that my holy text says no, or my holy text says that's a bad idea, then it's probably bad. Probably. You could have supporting evidence that makes it good, but for the most part, I think using religion as your sole supporting evidence is bad. That is a bad way to have any kind of argument, and leads only to bad things.
I agree with that. I think I'm going to amend my earlier statement and say it wasn't most like the temperance movement wasn't mostly a religious movement. It was mostly powered by religious people.
Yes, I think that's a better way to say it.
All right, I have my second bullet point note is this right here. White Protestants are the worst people in the world. They haven't been right about a single issue in 150 years. They got to slavery and they were like, slavery is bad. And they won that one and they got real high on the feeling of being morally correct. And then they just kept trying to chase that high and they've been wrong ever since.
Yep, pretty much about everything.
Yeah.
When it comes to social movements, for sure.
Prohibition was way more fueled by racism and bigotry. In fact, I would go as far to say there's definitely some of the dad's drunk all the time.
Yeah.
But
I think the things about this documentary and this section of the documentary that I find the most compelling and I found the most interesting were the parts talking about temperance as a precursor to women's suffrage. Or not even a precursor, but as a side-by-side to women's suffrage. One of the main arguments that women used to gain suffrage, gain the right to vote, for anyone who doesn't understand what suffrage means, was that they were being beaten by their drunk husbands, and if they didn't have the right to vote or interact with the government, then they would just continue to be beaten by their drunk husbands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, A, that's totally a legitimate argument, but not really because of anyone being drunk, just because, hey, maybe women should have the right to vote. That's the obvious answer. It has nothing to do with anyone being drunk ever. But I understand I think as a privileged white guy, I should take that argument at the most stock it should possibly have, because I have zero experience of being a woman who has no right to vote dealing with a drunk husband. Like, I can't even, like, trying to understand what that life would be like is hard for me.
Seems like a nightmare.
It sounds like the worst possible outcome. Like, I'm not saying our current society is perfect and that it has fixed that problem by giving the women the right to vote. It definitely has not, because there's still a lot of marital issues. There's still a lot of people, a lot of husbands who get drunk and beat their wives. And that's still just a thing that is accepted by society. Not entirely. Obviously, most people would say, hey, that's a bad thing, if you ask them. But the way our current legal system works doesn't always pan out very well.
Yeah. I don't think that... What am I trying to say? Women's suffrage needed to happen, and yes, women needed to be able to speak up and say, like, yo, hey, I know we're married, but this guy hits me. And yo, hey, I know we're married, but marital rape is a thing.
Yeah.
But they weren't able to do that. It was really early in this documentary where there was an interviewee, like a scholar, who said, you couldn't talk about marital rape. You couldn't talk about abusive husbands, but you could talk about alcoholism and temperance.
Yes.
And so it was sort of like a layer of innuendo.
You said
that. Oh, shit.
But continue.
So it was a layer of innuendo.
Yes.
That removed the thing that women wanted to talk about, which is a private and home matter, mm-hmm, to a more outside matter, which is their husbands getting drunk.
Yeah, alcoholism because, in general, became the issue instead.
Yeah, they couldn't talk about what their husbands did when they came home drunk, but they could talk about what they did before they came home, which was to get drunk.
Yes. Yeah. And I understand why that was a thing, and I definitely understand why. So if I was a woman in the 1800s, regardless of my upbringing, regardless of how religious I was, if that was the thing that was happening to me and I saw that opportunity, I would have absolutely taken that opportunity. And even though I don't think that's how that actually played out, I think it was more that there were a lot of religious women, because for most sexes, even today, women tend to be more religious than men. And I think that is more to do with personal freedoms than it is anything else, or personal, mm-hmm, or the history of personal freedoms, let's say that, that men have in general. If you were a man and you said you were an atheist, even in the 1900s, well, like, God damn it. I have my shot ready.
Maybe, yeah, I'm going to do what you do, and I'm going to pour one and have it
preemptively
ready.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, even in the 1800s, men could say out loud in public, I'm an atheist, or I don't believe in God, or I'm not, or I'm irreligious, or I'm not religious, or whatever. Mark Twain, famously, was not religious at all. And he and some other famous, I can't think of any of the other names at this point, there was actually a push in the 1800s and in the early 1900s of a-religious and atheist peoples who were men and politicians, because specifically they were not biased towards one religion or the other. Because Protestantism versus Catholicism was a big thing at the time.
Yes.
But at any time period you can possibly think of, until maybe the last 50 or so years, and not even 50 or so years, and well, since the 70s, 60s maybe, if a woman said that she was an atheist or that she did not believe in God, there was really not a lot of support for her in any kind of context or field, no matter what. And if you were in the 1800s and you were a woman and you said you did not believe in God, nobody would fucking listen to you about anything. You're lucky if they wouldn't just kill you.
Yeah, which also makes sense because women weren't allowed to work, so their only community was via the church.
Or family, or, yeah.
But where is their family going to meet?
Church.
At the church.
Which is another big thing, is that religion being so tied to social interaction, I think, is a big reason why it's been such a mainstay in society for so long, and why it has had such drastic impacts that if...
Well, that makes sense, because if you live in a small town somewhere in America, somewhere in the Midwest, if you live in rural Ohio in the 1820s, mm-hmm, and your town is kind of spread out, where does everyone congregate once a week?
This isn't mentioned in the documentary at all. What's another place that everyone congregates?
At the saloon?
At the saloon.
Which, exactly.
Yeah, but may be threatening to religion.
Yeah, men only congregate at the saloon. Yes, and women only congregate, are only allowed to congregate in one place. That's church.
Church. And I think, honestly, that's probably the biggest reason why this became a thing. If it was more common in the 1800s that women and men were both allowed to congregate in saloons, it might have solved some problems. First of all, maybe people would have been less uptight, maybe.
Ooh, okay, we're kind of jumping the horse here.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
We both know a good deal about Prohibition, especially after, like, Bar Smarts, because we've got a primer on it.
That did give us a primer.
One huge thing about speakeasies is that they were not saloons, which meant if you were a woman, you could get into a speakeasy if you had cash to buy booze.
Yeah,
and
because all they cared about was getting your fucking money.
I actually, like, Prohibition actually, like, really accelerated the mixing of genders in social spaces because they didn't care about social mores already. They were already breaking the law. Why would we also care about not having girls in our super illegal speakeasy? And I think it went away so quickly. Like, Prohibition... Oh, fuck. Got my shot ready.
There you go.
Prohibition went away so quickly because it accomplished its goals. That is to say, women's suffrage and women having a bigger place in society, including in social society. Yes. Once women entered social society through the speakeasy and everyone after a decade got used to that, it was... like, the writing was on the wall.
Oh, man, shit. I'm gonna be honest, though. That's such a back-assward way of fixing that problem.
I know.
It's, like, the worst. I mean, it's a good thing that it happened very quickly, but that is the worst way it could have possibly happened. But the main problem is that instead of addressing the actual undercurrent of issues... they addressed the, like, God, no. You got one ready?
I have one. Wait, did I say one?
Well, you just poured. Oh, you poured one to prep. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I poured one to prep.
I'm going to drink this one. Anyway.
But instead of addressing the issue itself, you're addressing a symptom of a symptom.
Yes.
Thinking that that will eventually lead to the remedy of the actual problem. Which, to be fair... I don't think anyone in that time period, or at least very few people, could have put their finger on
the exact issues that were
going on. The exact issue that was going on.
And obviously we have the benefit of hindsight.
This is true.
That's cannot be understated, but it's definitely very obvious.
It's so obvious in hindsight when you look at all the Women's Christian Temperance Movement and the Anti-Saloon League, when you look at their propaganda about... because they say they want to get rid of alcohol and they want to get rid of the saloon, but they also go on to say what they think that will cause or lead to. And it's all of these social changes that basically amount to women are treated more equally in society. Mm-hmm. But they go ahead and say, no, let's get rid of alcohol. That's the problem.
That was the wrong solution to the problem they were having.
They also went ahead and, over the course of 100 years since the temperance movement got going, added in basically everything. Mm-hmm. But it did start as, here's this grab bag of issues that are women's social issues that will totally go away if alcohol doesn't exist.
I will say one of the bigger things I can say of the temperance movement is it also adopted anti-slavery ideals, at least from some black figures. They mentioned one in the film, and I forget exactly which historical black figure it was.
The fact that you brought it up means I can't think of it.
Right.
He's the guy from the 1860s. Fred,
that bothers me.
Fred? No. No, I'm thinking of Fred Hampton. That's not it.
That's not Fred Hampton. If you're really bad, I can't give his name. I really disagree with what he said, but I understand why he said it. He basically said that if they were able to do the prohibition thing, if they were able to make alcohol illegal, the temperance movement were to succeed, that slavery would stop being a thing. He wasn't wrong, but he was right for the wrong reasons. That makes sense.
I don't follow you.
Him pushing that movement and other people pushing that movement may have helped the Civil War happen faster. But I don't think alcoholism and slavery were not inherently tied together. Not really.
No. In fact, alcoholism and all the issues that the temperance movement leading up to Prohibition tried to tie to it, alcoholism was not tied to any issue other than alcoholism, I feel.
Wife beating, I can give. Wife beating is the one I'm like, yeah, drunk assholes probably beat their wives more often than not.
This is true. If you had a guy who... But, okay, but then...
That guy's still just an asshole.
I know that there were definitely a lot more instances of physical violence in the past of all sorts. Because, if you ever look into, like... Fuck.
Child beating?
If you ever look into personal records and diaries from the past...
Yep.
Dude, even just the 1800s was so mind-blowingly violent...
Yep.
...that it makes it comical...
Now, even the 1980s, if you go back to the 1980s, like you look at 1980s sitcoms, the things that adult male figures were allowed to say on a 1980s sitcom about what they were going to do to... Okay.
Oh, like the bing, zoom, straight to the moon.
That's 50s. But even if you go back to like... God, well...
Even beyond that,
The Simpsons. The Simpsons.
Yeah,
in the 90s.
Strangling Bart.
That George... Bart? George Simpson. What the fuck? What's his name?
The George...
Homer. Homer Simpson. I said George Simpson. Who's George Simpson?
We have said the bad word too many times.
We have said the bad word so many times that we are very drunk. And we are drunk on a Prohibition episode. So I think it's fine.
Yes.
Absolutely fine. But anyway, Homer Simpson... strangling Bart Simpson in the 90s was not only socially acceptable. Well, I mean, it's cartoons. I mean, there's some distance between what that depicts and what is acceptable.
Yeah,
in real,
like Tom and Jerry existed, and Bugs Bunny existed,
but,
and people.
Yeah,
were...
my point is that if The Simpsons was a live action show and there was a depiction of a father figure strangling his son in live action, that would not have flown. That would have been super not okay. But because it's a cartoon, it's kind of more accepted for whatever reason. That's a whole other branching path we could go down if we wanted to.
Yeah.
My point is, physical violence against your family members and people close to you is like... has been accepted far longer... and far more than we admit that it has in our near history.
That is, I absolutely agree with that.
And that it was even worse in the 1800s.
Not only that, though, but what I was talking about is the prevalence of violence in society and culture in general. Mm-hmm. There was this thing that people used to do. I don't know what name it goes by, but it's where you put... a cat in a bag, like a stray cat in a bag, and you tie up the bag, and then you throw the bag into the fireplace as a form of entertainment.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. Yeah, that happened.
People are really fucked up.
People in the past were monsters. And so I do get and realize that domestic violence happened a lot more often in the past.
Way more than...
Way more often.
So, if you have it in your head... How I said it. if you have in your head an idea of how much you believe that domestic violence happened in the past, go ahead and like triple that, quadruple it even.
You said it a second time.
God fucking damn it. Fucking shit-faced by
this. Oh, no, I already told my partner, hey, there's a good chance I'm going to get pretty drunk recording this episode.
Damn it, I was not planning on this tonight. Anyway, I should have been. But the point is, if you were to imagine how much, like, physical violence happened between family members
in the between past, family members, between neighbors, anyway, on a daily basis... Yeah. It's just so much more than you can. Way more than you think.
Because the main thing is you gotta imagine. We have the benefit now of media. Media and communication is at a such greater level than it ever has been. That before now, there's not been a way to share that. If you were an individual person, getting your story out personally was so much harder than it is now.
Oh, that...
by a magnitude of levels.
That reminds me of a point I wanted to make, and a note I wanted to make, is that the IWW... Wait, no, not that yet. Oh, one tangent point. The sure. IWW, the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World, were for prohibition. Mm-hmm. Because they saw alcohol as a capitalist plot to weaken the working class.
They're probably not wrong.
They're probably not wrong in that time period, actually.
Definitely not wrong in that time
because, period. Because here's a statistic that I pulled out of the documentary from the very beginning. People drank about 3 times as much hard alcohol as people in modern people, 21st century people. Jesus, this documentary was made in 2009, 2010. And so they had statistics from thereabouts.
Jesus,
so that is
Christ.
That is a significant amount of alcohol, and it's because people have
that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's so much.
You have to think the reason why I can see why prohibition happened and why this was a problem because for hundreds of years people had been drinking booze constantly. It was drink at every meal because alcohol was a way to purify water, which was just chock-a-block full of poop and cholera.
Yeah. Drinking beer and wine historically has been a safer way to imbibe water than just drinking water.
Yeah,
for the majority of history.
Because if you take a glass of water and you make it 2% alcohol by volume, that's probably going to kill some E. coli.
At least some of it, like
yeah.
God, I have it.
But what I will say is that...
No coli in that.
Distillation that we learned in the Bar Smarts episode is actually a very recent invention. Taking recent, something that you...
In the last 100... Well, yeah, 200 years.
You can only get up to a certain percentage when you ferment something, when you ferment hops and sugar, because yeast will eat sugar and then produce alcohol as a byproduct. But at a certain point, the yeast will produce so much alcohol that it kills itself because alcohol is a disinfectant. And so you can only get up to such a high alcohol content. Beer is like, especially beer in the past was like, oh shit. Beer in the past was less than 5%. Wine could get close to 10%. The highest you can get with only fermentation techniques is sake, which gets with modern technology and modern techniques gets up into the high teens.
Really?
But that's it.
Huh.
That's as high as you can get with just fermenting.
For the record, distilling, why sake?
Sake, because they have a method where they use koji, so it's supplying sugar to the mixture the whole time. It's kind of like kombucha. Think of kombucha.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's supplying, the koji is supplying sugar to the process the whole time, so you can, and with the yeast they use, it gets it up to a higher level before the yeast all die off. All right, I'm going to take the shot that I earned.
You should do that shot.
But I will say, once people got around to distilling, which is boiling the water off of alcohol, it took a long time for people to catch up to what has just happened, mm-hmm. which is, oh, I wake up and I drink a glass of cider, which is 1-2% alcohol.
Maybe,
and then I go to work, and then I go to work picking apples in the orchard, and then a guy like comes by with a cart and he goes, hey, it's grog time, and he pours me a pint of beer, and I sit down and go, oh man, it's been a hard day, and I drink that pint of beer, and then I go home and I drink a pint of ale with these flapjacks I'm gonna have for dinner. Mm-hmm. Well, when distilling came around, people didn't really get how much of a difference 5% alcohol to 40% alcohol made.
It's a lot.
So you wake up and you do a shot of whiskey. That kind of sets the tone for your whole day.
Yeah, and I think that's the major thing. I think the biggest comparison I can think of, and this is a similar time period to, and this is like a historical thing that I delved into forever ago. Absinthe, the history around absinthe in general, is inherently tied to this exact thing, because absinthe was one of the first very popular liquors in France at the time, and it becoming so popular and it being such a high proof as it was traditionally prepared, if you didn't dilute it, made it very dangerous, because people didn't really understand. Like, we have the hindsight now of knowing, like, hey, if I take a shot of absinthe or I take a shot of any 40% liquor, that's really gonna fuck me up.
Okay, not just that, but when distillation was new, people did not know that you needed to cut the heads and the tails. So, well,
this is true. Like, there were
a lot of methylated spirits. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of really crazy toxins in those spirits as well.
Hey, you know what, toxins were super popular back then? Like in mercury.
Yeah, but also
which
like...
was super common because it was used in hat making at the time, which is just terrible for you. It's very
But also,
bad.
If you went back to the 1850s and you went to the druggist and you bought a bottle of whiskey, there's like a 0% chance that they cut the heads and tails.
They sure
so
did.
You are just going to be drinking what is known as methyl alcohol or methylated spirits, mm-hmm. where that's where all the rumors about what absinthe does to you, where you see things and you go blind. That's not wormwood. That's methyl alcohol. That's methylated spirits.
For the record, anyone who's listening to this, if you have had absinthe at any time, you will not get a hallucinogenic effect off of it. Unless they've added something else to it that will give you a hallucinogenic effect. Because wormwood, unless you smoke it or make a tea from it or eat it by itself, will not give you a hallucinogenic effect. Its hallucinogenic effect is so low, it is less than weed. It is less than many other forms of whatever.
But do you know the hallucinogenic effect of methylated spirits? It's really high.
It's really high.
And that's why listening to this has ever... if you feel like you drink red wine and you get a different kind of hangover that's harsher, that's because methylated spirits are not extracted from brewed products.
Yep.
So wine, and red wine in particular, has a higher concentration of methylated spirits.
They explain them as tannins sometimes. Red wine and whiskey and some other products that don't further distill or that don't further refine their product have tannins, but it's impurities. That's all that really means.
And well, tannins in whiskey is barrel. That's why whiskey is brown,
because it's
colored like a barrel. Mm-hmm. But with especially red wine, there's just a lot of methyl alcohol in it. Well, not a lot. It's totally safe to drink a couple glasses of red wine.
Yeah.
You can digest methyl alcohol. It's just way fucking harder on your body.
It will make you feel worse.
Yes.
You will feel worse. If you drink 3 bottles of wine, you will feel worse than you did if you drank the equivalent amount of alcohol of whatever other spirit.
Of like a distilled spirit that has cut the heads and the tails out.
But what a main point, equivalent amount of alcohol.
Yes.
So if you do the math and you figure out how much alcohol it would take you from gin to how much red wine you just drank, you will feel better if you drank that gin than you did the red wine.
Yeah, it's like if you take like 3 to 5 shots of gin as compared to drinking an entire bottle of red wine, you're going to wake up feeling better on the gin.
You will definitely feel better. And the gin even has like more introduced things. So like, I mean, if you drink vodka, even though vodka, don't drink it. Drink things that are better than vodka. You deserve, audience member, if you're listening, you deserve better than alcohol or better than vodka. Better. You deserve a better alcohol than vodka. I'm very drunk. We're way off topic. You deserve a better alcohol than vodka. Drink something better than vodka.
Okay, please. The last point I have in my notes that I wanted to make before we move on to the last section of the episode is...
This is a great idea.
The first note I have is a single drink of alcohol will kill you. It's that DARE-style propaganda where the Women's Temperance Christian Movement, Women's Christian Temperance Movement, and other temperance crusaders for about 50 years tried to hammer this propaganda message that even a single glass of whiskey will lead to addiction and you'll lose all your money and you'll go homeless and you'll go stark raving mad. What I found interesting about that is that it lasted. It's very much like DARE for anyone who grew up in the States in the 90s and 80s and early 2000s. Uh-huh. DARE was this program where they would send people to your schools to do the seminars about how if you smoke even a single joint, by next week, you will be strung out on black tar heroin and you'll definitely OD.
It's a gateway drug, Adam.
This scare tactic of basically saying everything from meth to cocaine to marijuana had the exact same effect, and that was to immediately addict you and to immediately within weeks murder you, was a bad idea, because within one childhood everyone figured out that that wasn't true, because the children that they said, hey, if you smoke marijuana, you'll get addicted and you'll die. Well, those kids grew up, went to college, smoked marijuana for the first time and realized, oh, they were lying. ... I wonder what else they were lying about. And then proceeded to do a lot of cocaine. But in this movement, in the temperance movement in the 1850s to 1900s, that tactic never stopped being employed, because I think a point that you made a long time ago in this episode about how if you were an individual person and you had an experience, it would take a really long time for you to get that message out there. Yeah. Well, all these kids in 1860 who went to class and heard someone say, never touch a drop of alcohol. If you touch a drop of alcohol, you'll become addicted and you'll die. They grew up, they drank beer, and they realized, oh, that was a lie. I'm fine. But that message and that experience didn't really propagate out to the culture at large in any sort of speed, unlike what they tried to do in the DARE program in the 90s. And that was my last point.
No, I actually thought about that while I was watching this, about the DARE program specifically, because I mean that is a thing that you and I have almost definitely lived through.
Oh no, yeah, I did. You know, one of my favorite things now is seeing millennials, like people our age, walking around in DARE t-shirts.
Especially, it's so good. I wish I had one.
I want a genuine one so bad.
I'm gonna look online for one that would actually fit me.
It's the funniest when you, especially when we were in college and we would go to parties and see somebody in a Dare t-shirt, you instantly knew, hey, that guy's wearing a Dare t-shirt. He has cocaine on him right now.
He has so many drugs on him right now.
If I want to do cocaine, I look around the party and I try to find somebody in a Dare t-shirt. They're the person I ask about.
Specifically Adam.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you if you've done cocaine. But I'm going to ask you, as a person who has worked in the service industry, how many people do you know that have done cocaine or have done cocaine around you?
People who I have worked with personally, like at jobs, not just people
like
who are...
Rough estimate. That's not even... This isn't that specific.
A couple dozen, at least.
At least.
Yeah. That includes... I would agree. That includes working in Evansville.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I know several people who, like, specifically said, we're going to do cocaine. Mm-hmm. That includes working in New Zealand. That includes working in Melbourne. That includes working in Denver, Nashville, and Columbus. Everywhere I've worked in the world in the service industry, I have known at least one person at my current job who does... Okay, here's a quick tangent story.
Go for it.
So
I was hoping for this.
When I moved back to Denver, I helped open a bar called Big Trouble / Kiss and Ride. It was a double concept.
Mm-hmm.
There was a beverage director and a general manager. The first week that we were open, I was closing, and I closed the upstairs bar, and then I walked down with the general manager, and we came across the downstairs bar, and it had the beverage director and another worker. And the beverage director said, hey, this was a great first week, yada yada. We had all done safety shots of Drambuie before. And then he said, yeah, some dude came in here and gave us a hit of acid as a tip. And then he pointed to a business card that had a tiny parchment square on it. And the general manager just said, wait, are you fucking serious? And he was like, yeah, it's right there. And then she looked around and goes, does anybody else want this? And the beverage director was like, I mean, no, go ahead. We're closed. Take it. Have a fun night. And she was like, okay, took the business card, folded it up with the hit of acid inside and pocketed it. And I was like, well, all right. If anyone's listening to this and they are not in any way involved in the service industry, just so you know, anytime you walk into a restaurant with a bar, or more specifically, a dedicated bar, everyone on the other side of the wood has so much more drugs than you have.
They have at least done twice as many drugs as you have. That's a rough estimate, obviously. What drugs they are, up in the air. But everyone has done drugs, for sure. Whether it's cocaine, or acid, or shrooms, or whatever. Everyone's done something.
There was a funny Instagram post that came out a few months ago where it just said, Tuesday at a restaurant, small kid has a birthday, six coke addicts who all sleep with each other start clapping.
It's so wrong, though, because A, like half the people in a fucking service group just are fucking each other, which is terrible. Don't have sex with your coworkers. It's a really bad idea.
Don't shit where you eat. Okay, I will
don't shit where you eat. Like, I mean, like, God damn it. It can work out. I'm not saying that if you have sex with a coworker, it will always end up badly. But
here's
in
what
general,
you do.
It's not a good idea.
It's not a good idea. Here's what you do. It's fun to date and have sex within the industry. Just don't date and have sex with people at your restaurant.
Exactly. Go to another bar or restaurant. Meet people there. You'll have things in common. The same things you'll have in common with anyone you work with.
Have sex with those people. But...
And then if things go badly, you don't have to work with those people.
Go
fucking figure.
Don't shit where you eat. You know what? That's how I met my partner. She worked two doors down from me at a restaurant I helped open.
There you go.
And she would come into the bar I worked at when she got off shift and order drinks for me. And now we're married. So
I'm proud of you guys.
It can work out.
I'm so proud of you guys. I'm super not married and still, from personal experience, just don't... Anyone you work directly with, like... God damn it. So there's someone you don't work entirely directly with. Maybe it's fine. If they're in a different department, if it's front of house to kitchen, maybe it could work out.
Ooh.
Maybe. Big maybe with an asterisk and like.
No, I still say don't shoot your meat. And especially front of house, back house, just don't cross.
Bad idea.
Just don't cross that line.
Very bad idea.
That being said, my sister, who is married to my brother-in-law, and they've been happily married for 5 years, was a front of house, back of house relationship.
It can work out. I'm not saying that it will never, ever, ever, ever work out. I'm just saying the cost benefit analysis of that is not good.
No.
It's bad. It's very bad. Don't do
okay.
it.
Okay, that was a fun tangent, but we've been going for like an hour and 10 minutes, so let's go ahead and get to the last section of the podcast where we have to create a drink based off this piece of media.
On the first part of Prohibition, which is mostly about the 1800s.
Yeah. I find this is probably going to be our most difficult one because we're not actually talking about... When people say Prohibition, that's shorthand for saying the 1920s.
Yeah.
And this is not the 1920s.
This is the lead up to that, which I think is the main thing. Maybe we haven't... We've talked around and about, but this is mostly happening in the 1800s. This is the Temperance Movement. So what are we doing? What do you want to do? My initial ideas are... do you want to make a cocktail that is alcoholic and representative of the area, of this time period? Or do you want to lean into the temperance part of it and make a non-alcoholic cocktail?
I absolutely want us to make our first non-alcoholic cocktail.
I was really hoping you'd say that because I had that thought while watching this, and I really want to make it. They're really hard. That's the main thing. I want to tell everyone. I think it's hard to make a really, really good non-alcoholic cocktail.
It is harder than making a normal cocktail.
I will agree with that.
Yeah, it's definitely not impossible.
It's not impossible, for sure. It's just that you have to either change your ratios. You have to add a lot more citrus and or sugar if you're doing a citrus-based cocktail. So the main thing is that you have to accommodate that liquid and that the thing that the alcohol takes up, you have to incorporate somehow, which is obviously very difficult. It's a lot harder than people think it is because oftentimes you're taking 2 ounces at the very least out of a cocktail and trying to replace it with something. And if you replace it with the wrong thing, it's going to taste bad, or it's going to taste flat, or it's going to taste not as good as it would have. Because if you base your ingredient, your cocktail, your non-alcoholic cocktail off of something that is alcoholic, then you're going to have to take out something and you're going to have to replace that with something else. Whether that's more of other ingredients you have, or water, or, whatever else. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. And to make it taste exactly the same is almost impossible, just because...
That being said, I will say that there are now a lot of non-alcoholic alcohol products. Things like Seedlip. Gifford has a non-alcoholic liqueur that emulates the taste of Campari.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I used that a lot in the last cocktail menu I got to make before the plague happened, and it was really cool. It was a lot sweeter than Campari, but it did still have that bitter, super bitter orange taste mm-hmm. in there. And to the point where we had a Campari spritz type drink that we recreated completely non-alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So you could order that, and or if you really liked it, you could order the non-alcoholic version. And I would say the non-alcoholic version, just as a single sip, tasted better.
That doesn't surprise me that much, but also that's kind of impressive.
You can do non-alcoholic cocktails. It takes more effort, but
it does take a lot more.
You can
effort.
Make them pretty good.
I do believe the thing you have to do is you can't just substitute. Like, you have to. God damn it!
You know what? I'm pretty sure I missed one. Probably during this recording, so I'm just gonna take.
Let's take this one and let's call it quits after that because
Let's call it quits because we're talking about a drink now.
I'm borderline hammered, and we need to figure out this cocktail.
It's because you've been taking shots of Manhattan and I've been taking shots of daiquiri.
That's probably fair. Mine's all booze. For the listeners, you can't see this, but I'm going to hold up to the camera for Adam.
Oh my god.
I have had most of a 375 of Manhattan, which is quite a lot. And then I've also had at least a third of my actual cocktail.
New York Sour. I drink my whole cocktail.
All of that with 100% rye, 100% alcohol rye whiskey.
You mean 100 proof?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm drunk.
I'm sorry. Okay.
The egg white smells really bad on this.
Oh, it's pretty old now, Bobby. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been sitting for a while.
Okay.
It's fine. Your Christmas bitters are great. They're not as good as Angostura about covering the egg white smell.
I mean, nothing is as good as Angostura. Angostura is,
if you're going to have one bitters, it's Angostura.
Have Angostura.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. So, we're going to make a cocktail.
Yes.
For this episode. The next two, we won't, because fuck Prohibition. But...
yeah, people are drinking.
People should be drinking. And in this episode, we're going to say they should, because historically, maybe they didn't for a while.
Okay.
I'm going to argue.
All right, I have.
So, historically, for this period, probably not a thing, but pineapple is not a bad ingredient to use for a non-alcoholic beverage.
All right.
So, it has a lot of ingredients.
I have an argument for a drink that I have made before. It's kind of cheating using one I've made before, but I feel like it would really, really fit this theme.
Go ahead.
All right. In the 1800s... if you sat down at a bar
mm-hmm.
or sat down somewhere and you weren't going to order booze, what would be the thematic thing for you to order to show that you were a teetotaler?
Is a teetotaler?
Oh, well, to show that you were a dry. Like, what would you... like, if somebody sat down and said, can I get you a beer? You say, no, actually, can I get a wholesome drink?
Milkshake?
That's milk. Veggies.
Milk. Okay.
So.
I'm into that. Okay.
A milk-based non-alcoholic drink.
Okay. That makes it a lot easier, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And okay. I'm going to say right now, we should use oat milk.
I agree.
Oat milk, because it is it's rapidly becoming the milk style liquid for bartenders, because it is
milk is the closest to regular milk that you can get with it not being regular milk.
I think it works way better than regular milk because it doesn't have screwy interactions with alcohol.
The texture works way better. And this is just me personally. I've been straight milk free for quite a while, unless it's an ingredient in a recipe that I'm using. that requires heavy cream or whatever else. Oat milk is just strictly better than soy milk or almond milk or whatever else you're trying to use. If you're trying to use a milk substitute, use oat milk. It's way better. Just do it. If your coffee shop has oat milk, use oat milk instead of regular milk. It's just better.
It tastes really good.
It's creamier. It just works better in as an ingredient to many things. Just do it. Just ask for oat milk. It'll work out great for you.
Okay.
But anyway, let's use oat milk in a cocktail until cool.
I have a non-alcoholic drink that I modified. Okay, first time I saw it was at Red Light in mm-hmm. New Zealand, and then I modified it for the most recent cocktail menu at Mouton in Columbus.
Okay.
But it calls for oat milk, or it calls for almond milk.
But I think almond
we should switch it to oat milk.
Oat milk, for sure.
And then it's basically just 2 ounces of alternative milk,
mm-hmm.
1 ounce of a cinnamon anise vanilla syrup.
That sounds awesome.
A whole egg, double shake, served in a coupe.
Okay.
But, okay, I think I'm going to do most of the heavy lifting on this drink because you seem kind of gone.
I am pretty drunk. I will agree with that. But I think that needs something. That sounds like a great cocktail. That sounds really good.
I think I know what it needs.
It needs something.
I want to use the Earl Grey lime cordial that you made me. So it's Earl Grey, but also has that citrus lime flavor in a milk cocktail, which sounds weird, but I think would work really well.
That sounds good.
Because it's not cow milk, it's oat milk, so it's not like water and oil. Like it'll emulsify together well. Earl Grey.
That sounds good.
Oh boy, Earl Grey lime.
I'm gonna
when we talked about doing this episode, you specifically said you were gonna make a bunch of little snackeries, which is what I made.
I didn't have any lime juice. I'm sorry. If I had lime juice, this probably would have gone a lot better. I'm not gonna lie. Next episode that we do on the second part of Prohibition will go much better, I'm positive.
Yes. We will not be doing this on... We're only going to be doing this for the Prohibition episodes. And by the end of this documentary series, we should have taught ourselves not to say the bad word.
God, I fucking hope so. I really, really fucking hope so. Anyway, yes, right. No, I do agree that cocktail sounds good, and I do like the idea of citrus and milk, actually, or like milk-esque thing go well. I would agree with that.
All right, we're going to also, I think we should still add the whole egg, because that adds a lot of body to
it. You should add the whole egg, and...
Or should we just only add the egg white?
No, I think whole egg is fine. You're doing like a creamier substance, and whole egg will probably be fine. You can do a flip with that.
I think we could do a flip, but we do have that like bright citrus element, which makes me want to do it more like a sour.
It might work better as a sour, but it's gonna be really creamy no matter what, and I feel like the yolk is not gonna really change it that much.
All right, so just lean into the creaminess.
I think lean into
just
the creaminess.
Lean into the strange juxtaposition of the citrus and creaminess.
Yeah, and this is gonna be our one non-alcoholic option. So you want to go? I would say heavy citrus, heavy cream. So those are gonna counteract each other a lot.
Okay. Okay. Balance then each other out. I'm gonna say double shake, serve in a coupe.
Mm-hmm.
How should we garnish this?
Some kind of nutmeg for sure.
Grated nutmeg.
Or even like cocoa. You could do the cocoa powder. That might be bad. I know.
I think grated nutmeg is definitely the way to go because this is an 1800s drink.
Oh, that's a fair point. Yeah. Do grated nutmeg.
Because they fucking love... If you ever want to know how much people in the 1800s fucking loved nutmeg, watch the YouTube channel Townsend. There's this guy who's just really into the 1800s and likes cooking 1800s recipes, like historical recipes, and also making 1800s clothes and shit. And goddamn, do they love their nutmeg. All right. So... I think we got the recipe nailed down. What are we going to name this drink?
So we are in Prohibition Part 1. What was it called?
Yeah. A Nation of Drunkards, which I will agree with.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. People were... it's one thing maybe we haven't fully mentioned is that people were drinking way more than they currently do.
People were drinking so much more, and people were drinking so much more methylated spirits.
It was like
if
bad.
Unless you've had moonshine and or like, yeah, unless you have moonshine, you have not drank like distilled methylated spirits. So it was harsh.
It was pretty bad.
Okay. I think I have a name for this drink. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the documentary, it talks about the first Alcoholics Anonymous style society that formed.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I found that really interesting because... It was treated really harshly by the religious portion of the temperance movement, which I thought was really shitty as a person who's not religious. And they were just like, "Oh, hey, you don't like alcohol, but also you don't like God, so fuck you."
It's not even that they didn't like God. It was this society formed because it was a bunch of men who were like, "Oh, all right, here's my last shot."
There you go, bud.
Cheers.
Oh, proud of you.
It formed because there were a bunch of men who realized they were alcoholics and addicted to alcohol.
Yeah.
So they formed a self-help group where they shared their stories and pledged to each other that they wouldn't drink alcohol anymore. Mm. And they kept each other accountable. And
without religion being involved at all.
There was a big backlash from the religious movement in the temperance movement, basically saying that, oh, it's not okay that you just don't want to drink alcohol. They thought it was immoral for... It's kind of wishy-washy why they didn't like them. Basically, the fact that they didn't have... They weren't a religious structure, and
because they weren't religious. That's it. That's the only reason.
It was a secular group just because there was no reason to bring religion into it. So they
Because they thought they could be not alcoholic without religion. That's literally it. It was literally that they as a group believed that without God's help, they could become non-alcoholics.
And through mutual aid, support. The fact they didn't like
social
that,
support. Yeah.
They didn't like the fact that users were helping users overcome their addiction.
I have a lot of things to say about that, but I'm not going to say them here. We'll talk about it later, probably, because I also have a big issue with Alcoholics Anonymous because it is inherently a religious organization.
It's pretty much the backlash to this movement in the mid-1800s is why AA is strictly religious now.
Yep. But anyway, your point was...
The point was that the name of that society was the Washingtonian Society.
Yeah.
And you know what? If a member of the Washingtonian Society walked into a bar and sat down, I think the drink that they would want to order is, hey, can I have a Washingtonian?
I like that. No. Okay, wait. Okay, so the cocktail we made... What's the full ingredient list?
The full ingredients, if you want to at home make a Washingtonian, you need to get 2 ounces of oat milk, 1 ounce of Earl Grey lime cordial, which, Logan, how do you make that?
You make that with a combination of lime zest, lime juice, and with the milk, that's going to be a lot harder. Well, the cordial and sugar. And I will absolutely, because I'm too drunk currently to do it, to explain it, will put the recipe for that in the description of this cocktail or this episode. It's actually not that hard to make. It's like literally just lime zest, lime juice, and sugar. That's pretty much it. The only thing you need is maybe a blender, but more or less, if you want to like mix it really well with a hand, you can do that. You're putting fingers up. I have so many likes. I'm probably going to drink the rest of this at the end of this episode, and I'm going to be really drunk. That's fine. But anyway, the point is, it's lime zest, which you can do with a grater and a lime, and lime juice and sugar. That's really all you need to make that cordial. If you want to make it with more flavorings, you can, but to make just a lime cordial, that's all you need, is those three ingredients. I'll put the exact ingredients and the recipe in the description, and you can figure it out from there. And yeah, Adam, go ahead.
Okay, so you need 2 ounces of oat milk, 1 ounce of Cocktail Conceit Earl Grey Lime Cordial, a whole egg.
TM.
Yeah, TM. You're going to double shake that, serve it in a coupe, pour it through a double strainer, because if you're working with eggs, it's always good to double strain. And then you're going to garnish it with a grating of fresh nutmeg. Just a shit ton of fresh nutmeg.
Because, boy, they like nutmeg. Just so much. Just as much as you can. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
And that is how you make the non-alcoholic cocktail, the Washingtonian. That is actually sounds like a really good drink.
The Washingtonian.
Yeah, it's a difficult name to say with your mouth, but that's a good way to tell if you're sober or not.
I think
not.
It needs something, but you know, we'll just go with the Washingtonian for now. I think like the Washingtonian, like, God damn it, I've said it so many times. That's why I'm really drunk at this point. The Washingtonian milk or the Washingtonian.
I don't know. I feel like
do you stir this drink or you shake this drink?
Shake it, double shake. I think that names exist to separate one from another, and there's only one Washingtonian, and it's non-alcoholic.
I think the Washingtonian shake.
The Washingtonian shake.
That's what I think. It's creamy. It's going to be delicious. It's going to be like a milkshake. It's going to be like a, you know.
Which
I'm saying it on purpose now.
Which does imply that there is a Washingtonian that isn't shaken.
You could stir this. I think it would be...
No, you can't stir this. It has an egg in it. It would be terrible. Stir this. Shake this.
That's the big thing. If you have an egg in a drink, or an egg white in a drink, you should shake that shit. Don't stir that. That's a terrible idea. Don't do that.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. Please tune in next time where we're going to have a guest on. It's going to be a recurring guest, our friend Ben Crockett, who's going to be talking to us about Survivor Series, specifically the headliner match that WWE puts on in the fall. And maybe he's just going to be here to talk generally about the WWE and wrestling. As a concept.
God damn it. Now we're going to have to do that. Like, that just ruins everything, Adam. You just ruined everything.
No.
You ruined everything.
No, we are going to fucking talk. We're going to fucking talk with Ben.
I guess we are now.
Survivor Series. And or WWE and pay-per-views in general.
It's going to be either great or terrible. We'll see if we all have to take shots when it's unlike.
Like. Good night.
Good night. Like, good night, guys. Like, it's the best. Like, oh my god.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode. I had a lot of fun. Logan, did you have a lot of fun, Logan?
I had a really good time.
Yeah, it was a really good time. We got drunk. We talked about a thing. We made a cocktail.
That sure was a thing.
If you want to hear more about the cocktails that we're making, follow us on Instagram at Cocktail Conceit. We post more than just the cocktails on the show. We post cocktails that we're working on in our outside life. And if you want to ask us about media or cocktails or anything in between, contact us by emailing overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Logan, how do you spell that?
I'm not spelling that, Adam, but it is overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Pretty easy to figure out. And if you'd like to further support us, you can join us on Patreon, where you'll get access to exclusive content and cocktails made by yours truly. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Oh, hey, there's Toby.
It's Toby. There he is. He's got a spot. What do you know?